Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I'm going to talk about sorrow and human flourishing. And I'll get to sorrow in a moment. And I'll talk about what Aquinas has to say about sorrow. One of the ways that Aquinas might suggest to us that we think about the state of our souls, morally and spiritually, there are lots of ways to begin to do this. One way, I think, for Aquinas would be to ask ourselves, what makes us sad and how do we respond to it? And we'll get to that in a moment. I want to start with a few broader comments about how Aquinas in particular, but also Aristotle, whom he's influenced by, think about human flourishing. So, and I want to focus on a couple things. I want to focus on what they mean by happiness, and then I want to focus on the role of the passions or the emotions in human flourishing. So Aristotle, in his Ethics, which Aquinas follows pretty closely on this, asks the question, is there an end or a goal to human life? And Aristotle says, if there is such a thing, it would have to be something that we desire for its own sake. We don't desire it merely as a means to something else. It would have to be, in a sense, complete. It would have to describe, in a sense, what it would mean to be fully satisfied as a human being. And as he talks about the criteria for the end of human life or goal, he says that some people say that the end is money or pleasure or honor. And it's pretty clear that money can't be an end because mainly we want money so that we can do things with it. So it's not desired for its own sake. Pleasure actually will be part of the good for Aristotle. But pleasure, he says, is common to us and the animals. It can't simply be pleasure that is the end of human life. And honor, if we have a healthy desire for honor, what we want in honor is a recognition by others of the good state of our soul, that we have done good things. But this doesn't seem to be something that we desire for its own sake. We desire it as a recognition of a state of our soul. So he eventually comes up with the proposal or hypothesis that happiness is the end of human life. It does seem that we don't desire happiness in order to do something with it. Right, we desire all sorts of other things in order to be happy. So Aristotle defends the view, Aquinas does too, that happiness is human flourishing, that happiness is the end of human life. It's important to see that for both Aristotle and Aquinas, they don't mean by happiness some things that we commonly mean by happiness. So they don't mean a state of passive contentment. So you're thinking right now about preparing for exams and then exams being done and your travel to wherever you're going over the break being done, then you're going to be happy, right? When all the things that you have to do are done. Or you might think of happiness as a state where you're just kind of doing nothing. You're just kind of vegging out, watching Netflix and eating and enjoying yourself. Nothing wrong inherently with either of those things. But that's not what Aristotle and Aquinas mean by happiness. They actually mean by happiness an activity. So it's not after you're done with something, but in the actual activity that we experience happiness. Think back, maybe not that far back, maybe to college experience, maybe something that you did recently. Think back, but maybe you go back to high school. Think back to when you were involved on an athletic team, a sports team. Think back to when you were involved playing or are involved playing in a band or performing in theater. And think back to the best performance in basketball or soccer or whatever it was, or in a band or in a theater performance. Think back to the best performance that you had, not just individually, but as a team or as a group. And think about what that was like. Right? What's that experience like? I think it has certain kinds of characteristics. One is that you feel a kind of elation in the moment that the performance is really going well and that all the work that you put in practicing in order to gain a certain level of skill or expertise or to master certain kinds of musical material is all on display, right? And there's a difference between learning to become good at something, a musical instrument, a sport, a performance of some sort, and performing it at a high level, right? When you start out learning to play something, an instrument or a sport, there's a lot of rote repetition, right? There's a lot of going back and correcting errors, right? If you had a piano teacher when you were young, they're really worried about how you're holding your hands, your tempo, and so forth. And they don't want you to cheat doing the exercises because you'll develop really bad habits. So they say, no, go back and do that 50 times again and do it right. Same thing with learning a sport, right? If you're playing basketball and you're little, you have to learn to dribble. Then you have to learn to dribble with your head up. Then you have to learn to dribble with your head up while running and being defended by others, right? There's a set of skills that you have to learn. And the rote repetition, you have to be very conscious of what you're doing, right? You have to say, no, I did that wrong. I'm going to go back and do it right now. You shoot a layup, go off your inside foot, things like that. It's also often tedious in terms of your experience of time. If you're doing rote exercises 50 times, you're thinking to yourself partly, when is this going to end? Compare that to when you actually get pretty good at something. Right, particularly a team sport. What happens when you're good at something, a musical instrument or a sport, you can't be self-conscious about what you're doing. You can't be saying to yourself in the middle of a piano performance, now move my fingers across the keys in this way because you'll be behind on what you're supposed to be doing. You can't tell yourself on a fast break in basketball, now do this, because as you're saying that to yourself, someone's stolen the ball and is going the other way. So there you lose, in a certain way, you're fully alert, right? You're in a way more alert than you are in normal circumstances, but it's not a self-conscious alertness. There's also a different experience of time, right? When you're performing at a high level, you don't notice time passing. You might look up in the middle of a game and say, oh my goodness, there's only 2 minutes left. The game is going by so quickly. And you perform at a high level with ease. It's no longer, there might be difficulty in the competition or in the performance, but it's not the kind of difficulty that you experienced at the beginning when you were doing things in a rote way. So Aristotle and Plato both think that learning to play an instrument or learning to play a sport is a good analogy for learning to become a good human being. You become good by performing certain kinds of acts, virtuous acts, over and over again. And when you're first trying to perform them consciously, especially if your character, as all of ours are to some extent, has been malformed to some extent, so that you're more naturally inclined toward a certain kind of vice than you are toward the virtue, you have to say to yourself, no, don't let yourself be tempted by that. Don't go down that path. And you have to perform acts that are virtuous, that are initially difficult and painful. But Plato, Aristotle, and Aquinas all think that the goal is to develop your character in such a way that you actually enjoy doing what you ought to do. Aristotle will say, you're not a virtuous person if you don't rejoice in doing the right thing, in doing the virtuous thing. Now, it's important to note that there, for almost all of us, there are occasions when virtue is going to be difficult and painful, right? And we're going to have to force ourselves, in a sense, to do the right thing. But as our characters become better and better formed, we ought to take more and more delight in doing the right thing. If you think of the first two virtues that Aristotle talks about in the Ethics, courage and temperance, And it's not by accident that he talks about these first. Because if you don't have some degree of these virtues, you're not going to have any other virtue. Right? Courage is about controlling your response, tempering your response to fear. Temperance is about moderating your relationship to pleasure. If you can't moderate your desire for certain pleasures, you're not going to have any other virtue. Because anytime something gets difficult, you're going to go for the pleasure and not the virtue. Similarly, if you can't overcome fear, when you face a difficulty, you're going to need courage. If you don't have that, you're not going to be just. You're not going to be generous. You're not going to be a good friend. These virtues have to do with human passions. In this case, the passion of fear and the passion of pleasure. They're also passions of anger and joy and hope and sorrow. My point by introducing it in this way is to say that for Aquinas, the passions are natural to us. Being virtuous is not a matter of eliminating passion or emotion. It's about having passion or emotion that's rightly ordered. Right? So the goal is for reason and passion to operate in harmony. Now, as we're trying to become better people, we're going to experience conflicts between our passions and reason or what morality tells us to do. And it's important in those cases that we listen to reason and not the passion. So there are going to be moments where we have to kind of smack ourselves and say, don't do that. But the closer we get to virtue, the less we smack ourselves. And the more we're naturally inclined, oh yes, that's what I should be doing. And we feel good about doing it. Right? This is a really important insight that's essential to the Catholic view of human flourishing, which is that we end up as happy people who take great delight in performing virtuous acts because they're good. Okay. So, the passion of sorrow. Sorrow is a really important passion for Aquinas. In fact, it's at the root of certain, at least one virtue, and at least two really dangerous vices. I'll talk about one virtue and one vice right now. Both envy and mercy are types of sorrow. It's important to see that for Aquinas, mercy is not just forgiveness, although it includes forgiveness. Mercy, he says, is a disposition to share in the sorrows of those who are afflicted unjustly, and if we're in a position to do so, to try to help them. Envy, by contrast, I experience, so in mercy, I share in the sorrow of someone else who's afflicted. In envy, it's someone else's good fortune that makes me sad. So for envy, I'm sad at somebody's good fortune. For mercy, I'm sad at their misfortune. Does that distinction make sense? So when I'm envious, and let's say it's envy as a vice, I'm not looking at someone and honestly saying and being right about it that they don't deserve what they're getting. Because if they don't really deserve what they're getting, then it's appropriate for me not to be happy about that, right? If someone who's an awful person suddenly has great success, that's not a good thing. And it's okay for me to feel sad about that. Envy is a vice, is when someone basically deserves their good fortune and I feel bad about it. Why? Because I don't have that thing. Or because their success or honor makes me look bad. At least in my own mind, it makes me look bad. So in envy, I make another person's good my evil. With mercy, I make another person's suffering my suffering. I share in it. So both of those are rooted in sorrow. So you might ask yourself, and we'll talk a little bit more about other types of sorrow in a second. When you ask yourself, what makes you sad and how do you respond to it? Are you motivated to be sad by other people's good fortune? Or are you motivated to be sad by identifying with other people's bad fortune, people who are close to you? And how much of this do you notice? Do we notice more the successes of other people that make us feel bad? Or do we notice the sufferings of other people and want to assist them? Two vices. There's also this vice, which we'll talk about in a little bit, called acedia or sloth, which is sorrow over the divine good. It's more complicated. I'm going to come back to that. When I was first reading Aquinas on sorrow a few years ago in an English translation, he talks about mercy and envy as types of sorrow. But he also talks about what he calls and what gets translated as anxiety as a kind of sorrow, as an effect of sorrow. And I thought, when I read that in English, I thought, that's got to be somebody updating the Latin so it sounds more like what we're used to. But the Latin is literally anxietas. It's anxiety. And then a more extreme form of sorrow he calls torpor or acedia. What does he mean by this? Aquinas thinks that when we are encountering an evil, something unwelcome. This is not just a moral evil, like somebody's being mean to you. It could be you've just gotten bad news, or you just did poorly on an exam, or something like that. Something that's unwelcome. But particularly something that you can see sort of approaching you and then overcoming you. So some affliction, somebody's really sick, you're really sick, someone you know is really sick, or someone who's close to you is dying. There are three stages in emotions that Aquinas says we experience with respect to evil or unwelcome things. Fear, when it's approaching, we experience fear. Uh-oh, something bad's coming. Then when the affliction is upon us, we're sad. We're weighted down by it. Actually, the other English word that's used here that I was a little bit suspicious of at first is depression. Aquinas says that sorrow is a kind of depression. It's a weighting down, and that's actually literally what the Latin means. So we experience fear at the approach of an evil, sorrow when the evil is upon us. And then Aquinas says, if that continues, another passion or emotion we can feel is anger. And anger, like fear and sorrow, can be healthy or unhealthy. Anger is healthy if I see something that's really bad going on and it makes me angry. If I see a serious injustice or harm being done, Aquinas thinks it's appropriate. There's a kind of righteous anger that we can feel. And anger also is an emotion that gets us geared up to try and fight against whatever evil it is, right? It may be someone who's doing something bad, but it could also be just a circumstance that you're going to have to find your way to be resilient and push back against this or escape from it. And anger is an emotion that helps us to do that. We all also know that anger can be really unhealthy, right? That we can get trapped in anger. And anger can get out of the control of reason very easily. When I was thinking about what Aquinas has to say about fear, sadness, and anger, I was thinking about our culture right now, which is we're a pretty angry people as Americans. And it really doesn't matter which side politically you're on, people are angry. Father Jonah Teller, who has been involved in the TIs now at the Dominican place at NYU in New York City, he said to me after he heard me give a version of this talk somewhere, he said, you know, the interesting thing about sorrow is that it's not really a transitive emotion. That is, I can't pass it on. If I'm constantly talking about how sad I am, I might make my friends also or family members sad. But pardon the rhyme here. I can get mad at you. I can't get sad at you. I can't project sadness. I can project anger. If you don't know what to do with sorrow, and it becomes more and more oppressive to you, one of the most natural reactions is to get angry. And you can get angry at yourself. How did I let this happen to me, right? We do that sometimes. But you can also get angry at other people. I think that in our culture, and there's a lot of evidence for this, beneath the anger are these deep pools of sadness that we don't know what to do with. People are experiencing higher levels, even before COVID, especially during COVID, high levels of feelings of isolation and loneliness, and connected to that, a lack of sense of belonging anywhere. You know what's also weird is that people on both sides of the political spectrum look at America right now and say, I don't recognize this country. This is not the country I, if you're my age or a little bit younger, maybe even some of you say it, this is not the country I grew up in. I don't recognize America. I feel isolated. I feel alienated. These are all experiences that are immediately connected to sorrow. What do you do when the sorrow is sustained? You don't know where it came from. You don't know what to do with it. Well, one reaction is to get mad. And it's easier and easier to get mad because we more and more interact with one another through these things, right? And our default position on social media is that, not all of us, but I'm not on these things, but I've been on them watching people enough to know that our default position on social media is that anybody who disagrees with me or my group is both stupid and evil. And I'm going to show everybody else how stupid and evil they are. Now, there are people, I have no doubt, there are people on X and Instagram and TikTok and elsewhere who are not all that intelligent. And there are people who are ill-willed. And maybe some people have both of those things. I'll grant you that. But increasingly, our default position, our first assumption, if somebody disagrees with me, is that they're both evil and stupid. And I'm angry at them. This is a kind of sorrow channeling itself as anger. So as I said earlier, it's really, even apart from faith, it's really important to get a handle on what makes you sad, why it makes you sad, and how you respond to it. Because sorrow not dealt with in a healthy way gives rise to bad forms of the emotions, in anger and vindictiveness, and it can give rise to serious vices. Okay, what do we do about sorrow? Well, sorrow is not unhealthy for Aquinas. This fear at an approaching evil, sorrow when it's upon us, and then anger to try and free ourselves from it, these are natural emotions, healthy things to feel. Aquinas lists, and I want to run through this, Aquinas lists five ways that you can mitigate or ease or assuage sorrow. I don't think any of these should be taken as, because he says mitigate or ease, they shouldn't be taken as cures for clinical depression, which, by the way, I mentioned anxiety and then torpor. Aquinas comes pretty close with the second one to some of the features that we would identify as symptoms of clinical depression. So anxiety is just feeling weighed down by sorrow. Right? I feel a weight that I can't get rid of. Torpor is a more extreme form of that. And Aquinas says it can make you not want to physically move your limbs. I don't want to get out of bed in the morning. I'm not motivated to get out of bed. I'm listless. I feel sad. And sometimes we can pinpoint a cause, at least initially, what might have triggered this depression. But very often one of the features of serious depression is that we have a hard time saying exactly what's going on. And it's really interesting that Aquinas says, I'm going to quote some Latin here for you. Aquinas says that acedia, this more extreme form of depression, where your limbs feel weighted down, he says that it amputates, amputare, the vocem, the human voice. He says, the human voice is designed to give expression to the desires of the soul. One of the things Aquinas is saying about serious depression is that we find it hard to express what our desires are, right? We've lost a sense of what makes us happy or even what pleases us. And we might have difficulty saying, what exactly is going on? He's pretty close there to some of the symptoms, and he's this is not original with him. This is all coming from the monastic tradition that Aquinas inherits about the passions of the soul. So how do we correct for this? Well, to mitigate sorrow, to make it a little less problematic, Aquinas says there are five ways to do this. I'm going to add a sixth, which I think is reasonable on the base of other things that he says. So the first one, interestingly, is tears. So crying. And actually, this is where you come closest to sorrow being transitive. Aquinas says we're, in a sense, when we weep or mourn, he doesn't think we should be walking around weeping over insignificant things all the time. But if we've suffered a serious loss of some sort, a serious personal loss, weeping and mourning are appropriate. And weeping, actually, Aquinas says, we allow some of the sorrow to pass from us through weeping. The other thing he says about weeping is that because we're rational animals who are affected by things, both spiritually and bodily, we know that in certain cases it's appropriate to weep. And so we in a sense, feel good about ourselves weeping when it's appropriate. That reason surprised me when I first read it. The second way to assuage sorrow is through friendship. If sorrow is a kind of depression that is a literal weighting down of the soul and the body, if friends share in it, in some sense that eases the burden. It doesn't feel like we're sharing it alone, we're enduring it alone because it's shared and distributed. But the more important reason why the presence of friends when we're sad matters, Aquinas thinks, is because if our friends are there in our moment of sorrow, we know we are loved. And that knowledge is a counter to our sorrow. Just to know that we're loved is a kind of appropriate pleasure that tempers sorrow. Sometimes just being present with a friend, even if you really can't do much for the friend, and it's hard to know in a lot of cases exactly how to help or how not to help in ways that might make things worse for a friend who's suffering. But this is, I mean, I think Aquinas has an insight here. Just being present with a friend who's suffering, or if you're suffering and a friend is present, Aquinas is saying, well, why does that matter? Well, that matters because you know that there are people who care about you. Right? Third thing that Aquinas says is contemplation of truth. So you can think, go back and you know, you're going to be studying for exams. If you start to feel down, just open up that bio textbook or your calculus textbook and just contemplate the truth. This is not working for you. For some of you, it might work, but probably not for most. I don't think that Aquinas actually has that in mind. In fact, he quotes scripture about Christ's redemption and contemplating the truth of Christ actually redeeming us from the miseries that we have in this life. I do think that there's another way to think about the way that the contemplation of truth can ease sorrow. Think about beauty. Think about something that you find beautiful and your experience of what is beautiful. So you're contemplating something that's not necessarily contemplation of truth, but contemplation of beauty. It's got to be connected to truth in some way. What happens when you experience beauty? I think what happens is something like what happens when you're in a high-level performance of a sport or a musical performance, which is that something that's beautiful arrests your attention and pulls you out of yourself. So that when you're encountering something that's truly beautiful, you're focused on what's beautiful, and you have a kind of self-forgetfulness in that. one of the real dangers for Aquinas of serious sorrow is that it closes us in on ourselves. And we sometimes compound the sorrow by only thinking about our sorrow, by being obsessed with it. And many times when it's serious, it's not a lot of choices we're making. It just is something that obsesses us, right? But that's dangerous, to get completely caught up in yourself in that way. And so something like being attentive to friends, right? Something like being attentive to something that's beautiful, for Aquinas, pulls us out of ourselves, and at least momentarily, right? Think about that. Think about if you're bothered by something, and then you go spend time with friends or family who care about you, and say during that time you don't really talk about what's bothering you. You could or not, but let's say you don't. If it's been a good experience with friends, you come away in a sense thinking that maybe what was bothering me is not quite as bad as I thought it was, or maybe at least I got a brief respite from it by spending time with my friends. I was pulled out of myself into something that's healthy and good. And that's one of the other, this one's actually kind of funny, Aquinas says, sleep and baths are good for countering sorrow. This is true, right? I don't know about the bath part, but sleep certainly is true, right? You can feel run down and think that everything is falling apart, and you get 7-8 hours of sleep and you wake up and you think, man, that's not really as bad as I thought it was, right? The reason for this, Aquinas says, is that sorrow of all the emotions, I'm not sure he's actually right about this because anger seems to me to be kind of similar. He says sorrow is the passion that most affects the body. We feel it most in our body. Fear, not quite as much, although we can get kind of gripped physically by fear. But sorrow, we just feel it everywhere physically. Anything, Aquinas says, that restores the body to its natural vitality helps to ease sorrow. So sleep, exercise, all of those things, which you're all going to need to remind yourself to do over the next week and a half as you approach exams, those are all things that make us less sad. Now, they're not cures for serious depression, right? But they all help. And especially in serious depression, things like friendship helps. Because, as I've already mentioned, one of the dangers with serious sadness is that we close in and we disconnect. And we think that we're no longer connected to anyone. And we're completely isolated and alone. And then we're tempted by despair. I skipped over the first thing that Aquinas says, which is in a way hard to kind of figure out. He says any pleasure helps to assuage any sorrow. Any pleasure whatsoever helps to assuage any sorrow. I think here he's simply making a matter of fact observation. And this, you might say, this point is in a sense amoral. It's not immoral. Aquinas is not recommending that we just pick any pleasure and use it to counter any sorrow. But he's saying, as a matter of fact, physically, for us, any pleasure will counteract any sorrow, diminish it, not eliminate it, at least momentarily. And Aquinas says, he has a really important caveat to this, provided the pleasure is intense. This is a matter of fact that's also a real warning to us, right? And it's a warning that we should not try to combat sorrow simply by finding the closest, nearest, intense pleasure. Right? It's also a warning that if we are deeply prone to sorrow or we are really sad, we are vulnerable to certain kinds of dangerous but intense pleasures. And especially if we have addictions of some sort, if we're sad, we're going to be tempted to go for the intense pleasure, whether that is drink, whether that is drugs, whether that is pornography, whatever it might be, provided it's intense, we're going to get that fix momentarily that takes away the pain. Right? It's a real interesting comment that he makes right at the beginning of this section on sorrow, and it's also a warning to us. Right? Don't habituate yourself to choosing the really intense pleasure to take away momentarily the sorrow or the pain, because Aquinas doesn't develop it there, but we all know the sorrow and the pain is going to be worse down the road, right? If that's the way we choose, that's another bad way to deal with sorrow. Okay, the sixth thing that I wanted to add, laughter. Aquinas doesn't list this. And in the monastic tradition, they don't want lots of monks laughing in silent periods, you know, so they're a little down on laughter. But for Aquinas following Aristotle, one of the other interesting things about Aristotle's view of human flourishing is that it includes virtues that we would say, well, that's a moral virtue, justice or temperance or courage or prudence. Aristotle also lists a virtue called wit. I mean, who would want to go through life without humor? Who would want to have a bunch of friends who have no sense of humor? Who would want to date someone who has no sense of humor? There's a virtue of wit. And all the virtues for Aristotle are means between two extremes. And it's the mean between being a bore who never enjoys anything and never laughs at anything, and someone who's obnoxious and thinks that he or she has to be the stand-up comedian in every moment of every event in human life. Right? So there's an appropriate way of exercising humor. Aquinas says also we shouldn't, quote Seneca, we shouldn't be a burden to others, so we ought to exercise wit. And laughter, he says, always increases joy. And joy is the antithesis of sorrow, right? Joy is the antithesis. So laughter is important because it increases joy. Laughter also frees us from ourselves, right? That's the other experience. If things are bad and you feel like you're all on your own and there are all sorts of pressures on you, get with some friends or some family and laugh for an hour really hard, and you will feel a lot better about yourself, right? Laughter is another mechanism for freeing us from a kind of unhealthy self-obsession. Last thing I want to say, the other vice that I mentioned that's rooted in sorrow, akchadia, or sloth, we call it. This is, for Aquinas, the easiest way to describe this. Sloth we think of in our culture as laziness or lack of productivity. That's one way of thinking about it. That could be partly true. Sloth is the absence of appropriate rest manifesting itself in disordered activity. So akchadia could be, I don't feel like doing anything. I got stuff I should be doing. I'm just putting it off. I'm not going to do it. I'm procrastinating. But akchadia could also be I'm constantly moving and never stopping. And I'm constantly worked up thinking about doing this or doing that, or I'm on this thing being endlessly distracted, where there's some sort of experience of activity, but it's pointless and distracting. Aquinas ultimately defines akchadia as sorrow over the divine good. It's a kind of despair. It's a feeling that I can't live up to or don't want to live up to what God is calling me to, or that God doesn't love me. I despair of God's love and mercy. Disordered activity that avoids real rest, times of silence, times of being still, times of putting away all activities and just having to be on vacation, literally in Latin, is to be empty. It's to be freed from, it's to have a kind of leisure that frees you from the necessities. We feel, no matter where we are or what we're doing, that we have to be connected. It's work or friends or whatever else is going on. This is, if we can't temper this, this is disordered activity, and it's a form of ecchadia. It's also, for Aquinas, rooted in, ultimately, a failure to take the Sabbath seriously, a failure to take the commandment that we have to stop periodically, put aside everything, and attend to God and listen to God. And we've got to do that more than just for an hour on Sunday during Mass, right? The Sabbath was a much longer period than that for the Jews and for Christians throughout many centuries. We need to reintroduce Sabbath into our lives, because it's there that whatever sorrows we're experiencing can be offered to God, and where we can allow God to heal those sorrows and bring us back to a proper enjoyment of virtue and of worship of God and love of neighbor. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.